Our next case this morning is number 042289, Durkin and Reed against Equifax Check Services Incorporated.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. In Bartlett, this court held that there are three ways that a letter can be confusing as a matter of law to an unsophisticated consumer. The Fair Debt Act prohibits sending letters that are confusing as a matter of law. On behalf of the plaintiff and the class in this case, we ask that this court grant the same relief as was granted in Bartlett, and that the district court's decision be reversed and the case remanded with instructions to enter summary judgment in favor of plaintiffs in the class. In Bartlett, the court held that letters can be confusing if they are contradictory, if there is overshadowing, or if there's a failure to explain. In this case, all three of those circumstances exist in the series of letters that were sent by Equifax to plaintiffs in the class. The letters were contradictory. Defendants argue in their brief that we can only win the case if there is a threatening contradiction and a demand for immediate payment. We think that sets the hurdle far too high. Indeed, in the Second Circuit case of Russell versus Equifax, which this court has cited approvingly repeatedly, the court held there does not need to be demands for immediate payment coupled with threats, although in this case, there are. In this case, the first letter, the letter that contains the purported Bartlett safe harbor language, demands immediate payment. It demands payment via Western Union or Monogram for same-day service or U.S. Postal Office Express Mail for next-day delivery. What could be more immediate than same-day service or next-day delivery?
No, the first letter, you mean the April 10th letter?
Correct. Well, it was sent on different days for different people. I believe for Durkin, it was sent on April 10th.
Durkin, yeah, that's the one we have here. And that though, that you're saying is okay, isn't it?
Excuse me?
That letter's okay, right?
The letter contains the Bartlett language, but you know, the demands for immediate payment via same-day service or next-day delivery arguably overshadow because, again, there's no real explanation. The key point in Bartlett is how do you explain how things fit together? And, of course, there's no real explanation as to how things fit together because the threats didn't start to emerge until the second letter and the third letter. In the second letter, you see threats. And, for instance, the second letter, which is sent 14 days, and these letters are all sent on a pre-timed schedule. It's sent 14 days after the first letter, and it says, should you fail to pay, steps will be taken to determine if your check will be assigned to an investigator or a collection agency. Now, that's actually worse than the language that this court found confusing as a matter of law in Chauncey. In Chauncey, what the defendant said is if you don't pay within 30 days of receipt of this letter, a decision to pursue other avenues will be made. So in Chauncey, all the defendant said is if you don't pay within 30, we're going to make a decision to pursue other avenues. Here, the defendant said a lot more than we'll simply make a decision to explore other avenues. They said that they were going to take steps, affirmative steps, to determine if your check will be assigned to an investigator or a collection agency, clearly stating that there's going to be some kind of escalation. And even the threatened escalation is confusing. Because what does it mean to say steps will be taken to determine if your letter is going to be sent to a collection agency? Defendant is a collection agency. And when defendant says they're going to refer the matter to an investigator, they're simply going to refer it to an in-house collector for telephone calls. So even those escalating threats, which are worse than the language in Chauncey, which just said if you don't pay, we'll see what else we can do, clearly violate the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act as a matter of law. Moreover, the second letter says continued refusal to honor this return check will result in your credit file being impacted with a negative reference, which may impact future credit granting decisions. Again, as in Bartlett, there's no explanation as to how this threat against your future credit, how it complies with your 30-day right to dispute, which hasn't expired yet. They don't reiterate the safe harbor notice. They don't state when these threats are going to be made. Are the threats going to be made within the next 30 days, within the dispute period, or only if you don't pay inside of the 30 days?
Is it your view that no communication should be sent during that 30-day period of the, I guess, what do you call it, the validity?
The validation period?
Validation period.
Well, since the court in Russell and in Avila held that you have 30 days to decide whether to dispute the debt, I think debt collectors send communications within that time period at their peril. Now, is there a per se rule that you can't send any communications during that period? No, of course not.
Well, the first letter says that the collection period efforts can continue during this period, doesn't it?
The first letter does say that. But again, just like in the cases where there's visual overshadowing, let's assume that you say you have the validation notice, but you contradict it with screaming headlines and big block lettering. Well, there can also be overshadowing by sending letters spaced over time. For instance, the second letter and the third letter, which is sent 28 days after the first letter, and the intervening telephone call, which is made between the second and the third letter, all serve to overshadow and distract the consumer from the warning in the first letter. First of all, I think it's reasonable to infer that most consumers aren't going to keep all the letters and constantly be referring back to them and have them side by side. The defendants say in their brief, well, consumers can simply go back and refer to the explanation in the first letter to see how things fit together. Sure they can. And defendants can also, you know, read fine print on the back of letters if they want. It doesn't mean that there's not visual overshadowing. Here there's overshadowing by sending subsequent letters that contradict and distract the consumer. And even if the consumer did go back and refer, imagine if the consumer laid all three letters side by side. Or even better, imagine if the text of all three letters was contained in one letter. Then it would be a confusing mess because it would have all kinds of threats against the credit rating and threats to refer things to investigators and no explanation of how it fits together. Defendants shouldn't be excused from their violations of the FDCPA simply because they spaced the letters out over a period of time within the first 30 days. If they had put all of those threats together in one letter, we wouldn't be here because, you know, I don't think any judge that looked at it would conclude that it's confusing. So why should the defendant be excused because they spaced the letters out?
Especially now, wouldn't an unsophisticated consumer recognize when the first letter comes in and there's a demand made whether or not they owe it? I mean, the validation period is so you can say, I don't owe this, or this is the wrong amount, or this is an incorrect charge, or I never saw this before, or something.
Correct. You have 30 days to decide whether to dispute it, and that's to give the consumer time, I would assume, in order to do a reasonable investigation. Look what happened here with Ms. Reed. It was a bank error. Now, it was not necessarily immediate apparent to Ms. Reed that it was a bank error. And, you know, the 30-day period is there to allow her to check with her bank, to get the records to confirm it's a bank error. Maybe it wasn't a bank error. She doesn't know. And during the time period, she subsequently learned it was a bank error. Or look what happened with Mr. Durkin. His checkbook was stolen, and the checks were forged. Well, maybe Mr. Durkin wanted to lodge a dispute within the 30-day period, but include a police report or something to show Equifax that his check was stolen. Why shouldn't he be given the time, like any other consumer, to gather whatever information or evidence they need if they're going to lodge a dispute, or if they don't recall whether they wrote the check, to confirm it? That's what the court held in Russell versus Equifax. That's what the district court held in Avila that was affirmed by this court, that you have 30 days to decide. Indeed, in Russell versus Equifax, again, this is worse than the situation in Russell versus Equifax. In Russell versus Equifax, they said that there was going to be a mark against your credit file. And the panel noted that at oral argument, counsel for Equifax couldn't explain what a mark against your credit file was to mean in terms of what is it a threat. Well, here they actually say worse than a mark against your credit file. They say it will result in your credit file being impacted with a negative reference which may impact future credit granting decisions. And then in the third letter, they go even farther. And again, this is all within the validation period. In the third letter, they threaten more extensive collection efforts. Should you refuse to honor your obligation, we will furnish info on your check to a National Credit Bureau for a period of 7 years. So they're promising essentially 7 years bad credit if you don't do something about this. And this is all within the validation period.
Now, that's the problem, I guess. If these letters were outside the validation period, that would be different, wouldn't it?
If these letters were outside the validation period, then that would be different.
And when you say that a collector writes a letter within that 30-day period at its peril, I think you said that earlier.
So long if they choose to make threats and don't explain.
Well, I mean, whatever they say is something other than I don't want your money.
Well, what some debt collectors do is they actually reiterate the Bartlett and the 30-day validation notice to remind and explain to the consumer and make it clear that, you know, they could have said, if you don't pay this debt, we're going to report you to a credit agency, you know, after the 30-day period, assuming you don't dispute it, just like it's like in the Safe Harbor letter. At this point, I'd like to save the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Legault. We'll hear now from Mr. Hartzell.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Your Honors, if you accept that argument, then you will be creating a grace period during this 30-day validation period. A grace period that this court had explicitly rejected, as has virtually every other court. This court rejected that concept in Bartlett. The 30-day validation period is not a grace period during which the consumer, you know, is free from further collection efforts. That's not what Bartlett said, and it's not what the Bartlett Safe Harbor letter says. The first letter that we used in this case, the initial Dunning letter that went out, contains the Bartlett Safe Harbor validation notice. We didn't change a comma. This is the notice that if this court said if you use this notice, it will be a safe harbor for you, at least in this circuit. My client uses this notice on a national basis. All right. This notice explains, Judge Posner wrote this notice. This notice explains the purpose here was to explain how the right to collect on the debt coexists with the right to dispute the debt. Those were the two tensions that needed explaining here, and this letter explains it when it says, in about the middle of the paragraph there, the law does not require us to wait until the end of the 30-day period before taking action to collect this debt. If, however, you request proof of the debt or the name or address of the merchant to whom you wrote your check at within the 30-day period that begins with your receipt of this letter, the law requires us to suspend our efforts to collect the debt until we mail the requested information to you.
Well, if you had in the letter, this the follow-up letters, the interim letters, whatever you want to call them, that if they reiterate this safe harbor, saying, incidentally, you still have that 30-day period. Of course, you might have to recite how many days are left or something, but that would cure it.
And how could you do that, though? How could you do that without creating even further confusion? My answer to that is twofold. First of all, the law doesn't require us. The statute's very clear. The validation notice need only appear it has to be sent within 5 days of the initial communication. It need only appear once. If you try to reiterate the 30-day validation notice in a subsequent letter, how do you calculate the 30 days? Because the 30 days runs from the date that the consumer receives the letter, not the date we sent it. I can send this letter's dated April 10th, 2000. I don't know when Mr. Durkin received it. I have no way of knowing that when I send my second collection letter. How can I advise Mr. Durkin of how much time he's got left? The only person that knows how much time he's got left is Mr. Durkin. And indeed, that's what the district court said in the Trawl case another case that we cited in our brief, that only the consumer, if he wants to know how much time is left in his 30-day dispute period, all he need do is go back and look at the initial collection letter. To reiterate the validation notice in a subsequent letter, I think creates even more confusion. So we gave the notice. We gave it where it was supposed to be. We gave it in exactly the form that this court told us to give it. We are not required to stand back and do nothing for the next 30 days. Indeed, in the Bartlett case, The letter that was issued in the Bartlett case was a collection letter from a lawyer where he threatened to sue within 7 days. And what the court said was, you can still sue somebody within 7 days. I don't need to send you three letters. I can take whatever action is legally permissible. I just have to explain to you what your rights are and how that coexists with my right to take action. And that's what this does. So the fact that we sent a second letter 14 days later and a third one 28 days later, where we advised the consumer of what the consequences of nonpayment would be, he wants to call them threats, whatever. We can continue collection efforts until we receive a dispute, and that is exactly what happened in this case. Mr. Durkin submitted a dispute, and Equifax Certegy immediately stopped collection, canceled the account immediately upon receipt of the dispute. By the way, Mr. Durkin, I believe, testified that as soon as he got this first letter, he gave it to his lawyer. His lawyer then waited until two more letters had come in before he finally submitted the dispute, which suggests to me that maybe somebody was trying to create a claim. But in any event, let me back up and talk about procedurally what happened in this case. There's really just two issues. One, are the plaintiffs required to come forward with extrinsic evidence to support their confusion claims? Two, if so, did they do so? The answer to the first question is clearly yes. The answer to the second question is no. This court's held repeatedly, starting with Gammon, through Walker, Marshall Mosby, Johnson, Pettit, and then most recently in Chuway and Taylor that came out earlier this year, that confusion claims are a question of fact, not of law, and that a plaintiff, at least by the time you get to the summary judgment or the trial stage, a plaintiff's got to come forward with some kind of extrinsic evidence to support this confusion claim. And this court has repeatedly had told plaintiff's lawyers what they need to do. Go do a survey. Do something. Come forward with some evidence that a jury can sit there and a jury can say, okay, how would an unsophisticated consumer view this letter? In Chuway, And it's not just a matter of confusion. This is an important point. It's not just a matter of confusion. It's a matter of showing that the level of confusion was unacceptably increased. This court noted, I believe, in the Pettit case, that there's always going to be some level of confusion. We're talking about unsophisticated consumers. There's always going to be some level of confusion, even if you just state the balance due in the validation notice. So you've got to show, their burden is to show that the complained of language in the letter unacceptably increases the level of confusion. In Chuway, which was the court's most recent reiteration of how this process works, the court said, this is the rule, if it's apparent just from reading the letter that it is unclear, and the plaintiff testifies credibly that she was confused, and she is representative of the type of people who received that letter, then no further evidence is necessary to create a tribal issue. In other words, that gets you to a jury. All right. On the other hand, if it is unclear whether the letter would confuse the intended recipient, then to make out a prima facie case, the plaintiff has to go further and present evidence beyond her own say-so of confusion, for example, in the form of a carefully designed and conducted consumer survey. The trial court in this case followed that framework exactly, even though Judge Hibbler didn't have the benefit of the Chuway decision, but he followed that framework exactly. He denied the plaintiffs, and in fact, he addressed this question on four or five occasions through the course of the case. When he initially denied the plaintiffs' motion for summary judgment, where they made the same argument they made to you here this morning, the judge found that it cannot be said that a violation exists on the face of these letters, and that therefore the issue was best left for the jury. And Judge Hibbler didn't decide that once. He decided it when he denied their motion for summary judgment. He decided it when he denied their renewed motion for summary judgment, when they came back and took another run at him. He addressed it on the motion for judgment on the pleadings, which he deferred and said it needs to be a motion for summary judgment. Fine, we brought it back again. He addressed it in the motion for summary judgment, and he addressed it on reconsideration. Once, and clearly here, I mean, when the judge said it cannot be stated that a violation exists on the face of these letters, what he is saying is that it's not apparent, going to the two-way test, it is not apparent just from the reading letter that it is unclear. He's saying it's not. So they can't even get over the first prong. They can't even get over the first prong. So that means it is now incumbent upon them to come forth with some kind of evidence. And they knew that. They knew that because they went and got an expert. They went and got a linguistics professor who purported to opine that he applied what's called a readability test to this letter, and he claimed that the on the basis of that the results of that readability test and kind of his own ipsy dixit that the letters would confuse the unsophisticated consumer. We brought a motion to bar his testimony as unscientific, unreliable under Daubert. The court went through the proper Daubert analysis, applied the Daubert framework, went through the analysis, and found that the expert's testimony was unreliable and unscientific. And I don't think that that finding is seriously subject to challenge here. And barred Dr. Metcalf. Not the first time he's been barred in the Northern District of Illinois from testifying. Once that happened, it was inevitable that judgment was going to be entered for the defendant because the plaintiff failed to meet his burden of proof. All he had was the letter and his own self-serving testimony that he was confused, and Pettit clearly says that's not enough. All these cases have said that's not enough. Plaintiffs had every opportunity here. Every opportunity. I believe the trial court went to great lengths to give them every opportunity to bring forth the evidence. When we brought, near the end of the case, when we brought our 12C motion for judgment on the pleadings, which I believed was proper based on what this court had said in Walker, the trial court said, no, it's not procedurally proper because the plaintiffs haven't yet affirmatively stated that they don't have any other evidence. Even though discovery had been closed, their expert had been barred, we'd been through motions for summary judgment. I mean, the judge said, no, they haven't come right out yet and said that they don't have any other evidence, so I can't give you judgment on the pleadings. You have to file a motion for summary judgment. Okay, so I flipped it around and I filed it as a motion for summary judgment. I mean, it was almost an invitation for them to go out and get some other evidence, and they didn't do it. So they were given every opportunity. Everybody was treated fairly here. The judgment should stand. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hartson. Sir, you have 4 minutes.
I'd like to touch on 3 points in rebuttal. First, I'd like to address this issue of the grace period and whether the fact that they incantate Bartlett exempts them from liability. Second, I want to address this issue of extrinsic evidence and the survey requirement. And finally, if I have time, I want to comment on Chewway, which the district court did have the benefit of. Counsel, I think, erroneously forgot that we did ask the district court to reconsider its opinion in light of Chewway, and it did read Chewway, and it decided to affirm its opinion anyway, and we ask that that be reversed. Now, the Bartlett safe harbor language is not some kind of incantation that immunizes.
Why didn't you get any surveys?
Surveys are prohibitive. Well, first of all, because it's impossible to survey hypothetical consumers. The hypothetical.
Why is it impossible?
Because the hypothetical
people who had received that same letter.
Well, the hypothetical consumer is a construct, just like the reasonable person, just like the reasonable stockholder, and we talk in our opening.
So you don't believe in surveys, is what you're telling me.
Well, I think it's not that we don't believe in surveys. It's that it's how do you find the group of people, of unsophisticated people? Arguably, if there are sophisticated people in your survey, it would be a poor survey. Also, how do you survey people to see the effect of letters going over time like this? I mean, actually, you'd have to conduct a longitudinal survey.
All you have to do is to get 10 or 20 or 50 people.
I don't know.
Receive that same letter and ask them.
If it was 10 or 20 or 50 people, I'm sure the defendant would be arguing that there's an insufficient sample size.
I didn't ask you about that. I said, why didn't you do it?
Because we did not believe that 10 or 20 or 50 people would have been a sufficient sample size, and it wouldn't have been a valid survey.
Then why didn't you get 100?
Because again, you have issues about whether it's possible to construct 100 people with sixth grade educations, 100 people that read it at what level, and then how do you survey those 100 people given that the letters come over time? If you show them all three letters side by side, you're not replicating the conditions under which the defendant sent the letter. You can't really put the phone call in there. We tried before Chewway, We did. We did try to see if we could bring forth some extrinsic evidence before this court in Chiu-Wei said that it's not necessary. Remember, there are essentially three categories. There are categories like Bartlett and Chauncey and Avila where the letter is just contradictory on its face. There were no surveys in those cases, and the court had no problem entering judgment in favor of the plaintiffs. Then there are cases where it really is ambiguous. For instance, in Walker, the question was, you know, does the phrase immediate collection amount to a demand for immediate payment? Well, that's not intuitively obvious that a demand for immediate collection is going to be construed as a demand for immediate payment. So the court gave plaintiffs an option. It said, you know what, if a judge isn't going to likely see it that way, or possibly even a jury, you know, but if you really think that unsophisticated people might see it that way, you have the right to conduct a survey. But I don't think this court is going to use this case as a way to say that a survey or extrinsic evidence must always be provided. This court has rejected that position repeatedly in the past. At a minimum, under Chiu-Wei, we get a trial. We think you should reverse outright and enter judgment just like in Bartlett and Chauncey. But at a minimum, we get a trial because it's ambiguous. Even the district court found that there were tactics engaged in not to be condoned and that the letters could potentially confuse. I see that my time is up. I ask that the court reverse the district court's decision and enter summary judgment in favor of the plaintiffs and the class or remand for trial.
Well, our thanks to both Mr. Legone and Mr. Hartzell, and the case will be taken under advisement.